Buying or selling your home? Real Estate for Life can connect you with a pro-life real estate agent. When Real Estate for Life receives a referral fee, they donate 65% to Catholic Answers. Learn more at realestateforlife.org. Hello and welcome to Catholic Answers Live. I am Cy Kellett, your host, as happy as can be to be back here with you on a Tuesday. Usually I feel this happy on a Monday because I'm getting going on another week, but Tuesday we're starting this week because Labor Day was yesterday and that was a pre-recorded show with Joe Heschmeyer. Today, not pre-recorded, totally completely live. Carlo Broussard here with us for both hours. And our topic, which Catholic doctrine troubles you? Is there a Catholic doctrine that you have trouble with, whether you're Catholic or not? If you're not a Catholic, maybe it's something that is keeping you even from considering Catholicism because you're troubled by some doctrine of the church. Or maybe it's just one last hurdle you want to overcome. You're welcome to call 888-318-7884. Or maybe you're a Catholic because lots of Catholics have trouble with various doctrines. As a matter of fact, it would be pretty odd to go through your entire life and never have trouble with any of them. Maybe it's trouble understanding, maybe it's trouble accepting, whatever it is. If there's a Catholic teaching, something that the church teaches that you have trouble with, 888-318-7884. Anybody is welcome, and everybody is welcome. Carlo Broussard is our guest. He's an apologist here at Catholic Answers, writer of a whole bunch of books, including Prepare the Way, Overcoming Obstacles to God, the Gospel, and the Church, in which he deals with some of the doctrines of the church as obstacles. Lots of other books as well. And he's also the podcaster behind the podcast Sunday Catholic Word. Carlo, thanks for being here.
Hey, Cy, thanks for having me, man. It's always great to be on with you. Looking forward to the 2 hours.
Did you get a day off or not? Like, I don't know about you. Like, I never know if you're going to get a day off or you're just going to work through. Oh, you had to work, huh? All right.
I did a little work.
You are not really the day off kind of guy.
But it was justified because the family and the kids were doing school for a half a day because our homeschooling schedule is quite flexible. And so we decided to do some schooling yesterday morning. So I was like, hey, if the kids are going to be working, I guess I'm going to get some work done. So it's quite nice to be able to come into the studio when nobody else is in the building, you know, so you don't have any weed eaters or grass blowers going around and messing up the recordings.
Oh, so you were recording. You were getting some recording done.
Yeah, I was getting some recording done, yeah. Both for my local radio show here in Tulsa on St. Michael Catholic Radio called The Catholic Reason and for Sunday Catholic Word, getting some recording done, yeah.
The number is 888-318-7884. You got something that troubles you about the Catholic faith, you are welcome to call 888-318-7884. Now, wait a second. You were just on the road, though, weren't you?
Yes, I was. Last week, I was at Our Lady of Hope Catholic Church in Washington, Indiana. So a shout out to all those good folks there. I gave a 3-night parish mission. Wonderful people, very warm and welcoming. We had a great time. Good turnout, too, as well. It's a little bitty town, right? Super small town, but, man, some good folks. I enjoyed my visit with all those who were hosting me there, and we had some great conversations about the possibility of me going back. I also spoke to their 6th through 12th grade students. They have a parish school associated with it. And then I also spoke at Mater Dei in Evansville, Indiana, to over 500 students there and spoke on the topic of religion. Why should I care? Actually, apologetics for an age of unbelief. So had a great time, man. It's good to be back, though, to be back on the air with you and in the saddle. And I'm looking forward to our conversation today.
So how'd they find you? Did they go to CatholicAnswerSpeakers.com or had they?
Yes. So they had heard me on the radio and in their meeting about trying to book a speaker, somebody suggested my name. And so they actually went to CatholicAnswerSpeakers.com, filled out the inquiry form, and our wonderful seminar coordinator, Jennifer Phelps, was on it and booked it right away. So if anybody listening wants to bring me out to speak at their event, a parish mission or conference, or even at their university for me to come give a lecture, they can reach out to Jennifer Phelps either at CatholicAnswerSpeakers.com, or they can just call Catholic Answers. See if I can remember that. 619-387-7200, I think, is the customer service line. And just ask to speak to Jennifer Phelps, and she'll hook you up.
CatholicAnswerSpeakers.com. All right, I'll tell you what. I don't know if this is good or bad, but a lot of people apparently have doctrines of the church that trouble them because the lines are full. Except for one, the lines are full. So off we go. Steve's in Maine listening on WEGP radio. Steve, thank you very much for starting us off. You got a Catholic doctrine that troubles you?
Yes, this is a doctrine that does. Why did the Catholic Church make marriage a sacrament?
Okay. Well, the Catholic Church, one point of clarification would be that the Catholic Church didn't make marriage a sacrament. In order to clarify exactly what we believe, at least for us as Catholics, we believe that Jesus actually instituted the sacrament of marriage, or at least maybe let me retract and clarify that. Jesus raised the natural institution of marriage to a level of the sacrament. And we see some biblical foundation of this in Matthew chapter 19, for example. I think Matthew chapter 5, Jesus teaches it as well. I was just studying Mark chapter 10. That's Mark's version of Jesus' teaching, to where he's having a conversation, Steve, with the Pharisees there who are posing to him the question, what do you say about Moses' permission of divorce and remarriage? Now, the historical context there is that one school of Jewish thought said that a man could divorce his wife for any reason. Another school of thought said that a man could divorce his wife and remarry only in the cases of spousal infidelity or adultery. And the Pharisees posed to Jesus, what do you say? They're trying to get Jesus to pitch his tent, so to speak, in one of the schools of Jewish thought. And what Jesus does is he responds to the question in the negative by appealing to the beginning and says, in the beginning, it was not so. That is, no divorce whatsoever. And then gives us the teaching of what God has joined together, let no man put asunder. And so Jesus's answer is, I'm not pitching my tent in any camp of the Jewish schools of thought concerning whether a man can divorce his wife and remarry, because the assumption was that if a man puts away his wife, he's free to remarry. But Jesus says, no, that's not the case, for if a man does that, puts away his wife, marries another, he's committing adultery. The implication being that he's not free to marry because he's still bound to the woman that he just put away with the bill of divorce. And throughout the century, Steve, the church has reflected upon that data of revelation and come to the understanding, given the apostolic tradition, which would be a testimony to the sacred tradition, that in this teaching that Jesus gives us, he is elevating what is natural, marriage, to the level of a sacrament, which we believe as Catholics that whenever two baptized individuals profess those vows and become married, that bond is now taken on a supernatural character, in virtue of which the spouses can actually communicate graces to each other, ultimately coming from Jesus Christ. And so not only do you have the indissolubility of marriage being revealed to us by our Lord, that's one aspect of the sacrament of marriage, but the other aspect is, given our Lord's revelation about the sacrament of baptism and what we believe about baptism, that comes into play as well concerning the bond between a husband and wife taking on a supernatural character in virtue of the supernatural character that the husband and the wife have by way of their baptism. And so those would be a couple of routes that we could take to begin having this conversation of where the church looks to in the data of divine revelation concerning marriage being a sacrament, that is, a sense perceptible sign that communicates the grace it signifies, right? So you have the husband and the wife baptized, husband baptized wife, a sense perceptible sign of their natural union of marriage, but communicating the grace that it signifies, the grace of union, and the graces that would be needed to live out that union perpetually so, given the indissolubility of marriage. So that's what I would say to that.
Oh, okay. Why have Protestants rejected it as a sacrament?
Well, this gets, well, I mean, some Protestants would acknowledge that if you have two baptized individuals, they would conclude that that's something that's going to communicate grace. And even we as Catholics would acknowledge that, that if you have two baptized individuals within, even within a Protestant community, and they get married, we're going to presume that that's an indissoluble bond, unless some other evidence could be put forward to show that they actually weren't married in the first place. And so marriage is a sacrament that we would acknowledge to be present even among Protestant Christians, precisely because of the other sacrament that we acknowledge that they have, namely baptism, if they use proper form, matter, and they have the intention to do what the church intends to do. So baptism and marriage would be a sacrament that at least we as Catholics would acknowledge. Now, there is one caveat here that among many Protestant communities, they would deny that indissoluble aspect of the sacrament of marriage and think or believe and conclude that in some cases of spousal infidelity, the divorce that one bestows upon an, or that one gets with the other spouse, dissolves the bond such that they can go and remarry. And this is why we as Catholics pretty much are standing alone here in this idea that there is no divorce and remarriage, assuming that the bond was created by God in the first place. And so that would be one aspect of the sacrament of marriage that our Protestant, some of our Protestant brothers and sisters would be in disagreement with us about.
Steve, that brings us to the break. Thank you for starting us off. We're talking with Dr. Carlo Broussard. I don't know why I couldn't say doctor. Dr. Broussard, I'm not at all offended to call you doctor. It just got stuck. Dr. Carlo Broussard, our guest, we're talking about which Catholic doctrine troubles you. If there's a Catholic doctrine that bothers you, whether you're Protestant, Catholic, or other, you are welcome to call 888-318-7884.
Catholic Answers Live. Do you have a question but prefer to ask it privately? Catholic Questions can help. Go to CatholicQuestions.com to ask your question online, email us, drop us a letter, or give us a call. Longtime Catholic Answers Live apologist and author Jim Blackburn or another Catholic Questions apologist will be happy to assist you. Catholic Questions proudly supports Catholic Answers Live, so visit us at CatholicQuestions.com today. That's CatholicQuestions.com.
Underwriting for Catholic Answers Live is provided by Magnificat. Published monthly, Magnificat features texts of daily mass, prayers, articles, meditations, art commentaries, and more, in step with the liturgical rhythm of the Church, on the web at Magnificat.com.
Another great podcast on EWTN Podcast Central is Letters from Home. This is your guide through the scripture readings of the daily mass with theologians from the St. Paul Center. You can hear this and other faith-filled podcasts from our friends and affiliates around the world, all in one place, all free at EWTN Podcast Central. Visit EWTN.com/radio and click on Podcast Central today.
Welcome back. Catholic Answers Live. The early church was the Catholic Church. Can you explain that to a friend or family member? If not, we've got just the ticket. The early church was the Catholic Church is the best-selling book by apologist Joe Heschmeyer. It spells out for you in ways that are easy to understand and pass on to others all the interesting details of the early church. And we're talking about the early church, first 200 years of the church. Best thing about this, great book. Well, it's maybe not the best thing, but it's $10 right now, plus free shipping, as long as you're in the United States. Pick this fantastic resource up today at shop.catholic.com. The early church was the Catholic Church. Just $10, free shipping right now in the United States at shop.catholic.com. Dr. Carlo Broussard is our guest. And again, I don't know whether to be happy about this or not, but lots of people have troubles with Catholic doctrines, apparently, because the phone lines are full. Which Catholic doctrine troubles you is our topic today. And off to Texas we go. Gabe is in Texas. Gabe, thanks for the call. Which Catholic doctrine troubles you?
I wanted to follow up on a conversation I had last week. I was the last one to call. It was Stacey Chansakos.
Oh, yeah. Okay. Right. Welcome back, Gabe.
Oh, thank you. Well, I could ask for empirical, objectively verifiable, observable, repeatable, test of evidence that your religious convictions are true, and I wanted no logical fallacies and no Bible verses.
No Bible verses. Yeah, just give us the logic, not the Bible verses. Is that right, Gabe?
Yes.
Okay.
She responded with a logical fallacy, but I wasn't able to respond back.
Okay.
All right, so is this in response to something I was saying on the air or somebody else?
No, Stacy, Dr. Stacy was talking about faith and science last Friday. That was the last hour we did.
And okay, so I'm missing the precise question.
All right, so Gabe, say it slowly because there's a lot of details in it, but do we have what kind of evidence for our faith?
Empirical, objectively verifiable, observable, repeatable, and testable evidence. Kind of like how we have for evolution.
Okay, all right. So if you're going to require some sort of empirical evidence that we could go and verify with our senses using the methods of modern science in order to establish the truth of a claim concerning history or the truth of a claim concerning an individual person who walked the face of the earth historically, then that would be a category mistake. We're not going to be able to give you any sort of empirical data that could compel your intellect to affirm the truth of these claims, as opposed to my claim being it's raining outside and you go and look, right? So that's just a category mistake of employing the wrong kind of tool in order to assess the truth value of a claim. Now, maybe you're coming from a position that the methods of modern science are the only tools we have in order to have real knowledge. And if that's the case, then we're going to have a conversation about what we call in philosophy scientism, that scientific knowledge is the only real kind of knowledge. That would be a bit of a problematic statement because that statement itself cannot be proven. The truth value of that statement couldn't be proven by using the methods of modern science. Therefore, it wouldn't be scientific knowledge. But I'm going to put that off to the side right now. And so specifically to answer your question is that we could employ the type of evidence that historians would look for in order to verify the truth of certain claims. When we look at the historicity of the gospel narratives and employing the certain criteria like multiple attestation, enemy attestation, and criterion of embarrassment, and all of that stuff, in order to assess the likelihood and reliability of ancient reports of ancient events, like in the case of Jesus. And whenever we do that research, right, this is just a sketch, by the way, Gabe, but whenever we do that research, in my judgment and many others, we come to the conclusion like, this is historically reliable reports. And so given that the historical data is sound, it provides us reason to make the conclusion that Jesus is who he says he is. So that would be a sketch of sort of the approach that we would take to look at quote unquote empirical evidence, not that which you can verify with your own five senses, but the evidence that historians look to in order to establish the reliability of claims made in the past. Now, there is another approach that might be kind of what you're looking for that's a little bit closer home to the scientific evidence. And Gabe, I would invite you to consider the evidence from the miracles in the Catholic Church. And so, for example, you have the miracles of the saints. You know, every saint that's canonized and beatified, there are records of miracles, wondrous effects that have been brought about that can reasonably only be explained by divine power that are specifically connected with their intercessory prayers. And so this is going to be one example in my forthcoming book on the intercession of the saints, and that is the healing of baby James Fulton Engstrom in 2010 in Peoria, Illinois, where he was born without any heartbeat and was in cardiac arrest for 61 minutes, over an hour between the time he came out the womb and at the hospital. And then all of a sudden, at the time when the parents started interceding for Bishop Fulton Sheen to pray, James came back to life. And his heart was beating with 148 beats per minute, like a healthy newborn baby. So that would be one example, Gabe, of a an acclaimed miraculous effect due to divine power, and that's specific with a saint in the Catholic Church. And then you can also look to the miracles of the Eucharist, like the miracle of Lanciano, where you have what has been scientifically verified and tested to be human flesh and human blood in 1970 by Dr. Linoli, if I'm remembering that correctly. I can't remember his name. I'm going to have to research that. But in the miracle of Lanciano, that was verified, that was consecrated bread over 1,300 plus years. It changed in AD 700 to what empirically was verified to be human flesh and human blood, and was existing over 1,300 years. And so, Gabe, such an effect wouldn't compel the intellect immediately to conclude that Catholicism is true, but at least such testimonies of the miraculous could provide the intellect a reason, a justifiable reason, to conclude that Catholicism is true, along with all of the other evidence that we would have to look to concerning the historical evidence of St. Peter being the first pope and his historical successors and all that jazz. But the point here is that we can employ certain types of evidence that can provide the intellect rational justification to assent, moved by the will, to the proposition that Catholicism is true. So that's the approach, that's the sketch that we would employ in order to make good on that claim that Catholicism is true. Now, again, if you're not going to allow into the court of law, so to speak, right, on the witness stand, the historical evidence or the miraculous evidence because of your preconceived philosophical ideas, well, then that's where the conversation would have to start, to see if we can remove some of those preconceived philosophical views that we would say would be flawed. And we would have to have the conversation start there before we move forward to assess any other kind of evidence.
Okay. Could I respond to some of it?
You'd have to be kind of quick, Gabe. We have a couple minutes, though, but I would like it to be a little conversation between you and Carlo, because I'm very interested in this, actually. So, yeah, please go ahead.
You mentioned the miracle of Lanciano. I don't know if you called the atheist experience. Like, someone actually called about that last week just to talk about it. But how would that prove that Catholicism is true?
Well, it wouldn't prove Catholicism is true in and of itself, because obviously the Orthodox believe that Jesus is really present in the Eucharist too. But my point here would be, this would be a piece of evidence that would have to be employed to put in the pile of evidence, a converging set of evidences that are happening within the Catholic Church. And whenever you look at all these different lines of evidences in the Catholic Church, along with miracles of the saints, miracles of the Eucharist, and other things, right, all converging together, those different lines of evidences converging together within the Catholic Church would provide someone a rational ground to assent to the proposition that Catholicism is true. So I concede, I acknowledge that the miracle of Lanciano would not by itself prove Catholicism is true. I think it does provide really strong evidence that Jesus is really present in the Eucharist, and the words of consecration and what's going on there, there's something mystical and real going on, as Orthodox and Catholics say. But it wouldn't prove Catholicism is true by itself. But it would be one piece of evidence, along with other pieces of evidence taking place in the Catholic Church, that could rationally lead someone to the conclusion that Catholicism is true. So that's how I would assess that.
Okay, Gabe?
Okay. Is there any way I can have like a more in-depth conversation with someone instead of just like...
Yes.
A 5-minute conversation.
We would love to set that up, Gabe. I'll tell you what we'll do. I'll put you on with Edgar, and because we'd love to have that conversation, either on air or in private, however you would prefer. I'd also like to send you a copy of Carlo's book, Prepare the Way, Overcoming Obstacles to God, the Gospel, and the Church, because that's what he does there, is help overcome obstacles. But if you give some contact information to Edgar, we will follow up with you, and we'll make sure that we have some one-on-one conversation with you. Thanks, Gabe. What a nice thing. That's very nice to get to hear from Gabe, to have those conversations. Carlo, I'm always so glad it's you that has those conversations, because I don't know what to say.
Hey, man, I'm shooting from the hip as well here, brother.
Yeah, you did all right. But I was thinking as you were saying that I probably should think of this, but I never think of things in the moment that I should think of them. But the fact is that Christianity is a faith rooted in historical claims. And so What is required is to give convincing historical evidence, or at least to be able to present convincing historical evidence in support of the faith. And that's a whole lot different than giving scientific evidence. But I can't give scientific evidence that Abraham Lincoln lived. I have to marshal historical evidence for that claim.
Yeah, if you mean by scientific evidence like that which is subject to empirical verification, right?
Yeah.
Some people might lump historical evidence in the quote-unquote general category of scientific evidence, like something that's different than philosophy or, you know, religious faith or something. So, but absolutely. We got it. There are different tools in the tool shed that we can use, man. To use Ed Fazer's example, which is brilliant, if you're going to go looking for plastic cups on the beach, you don't bring your metal detector. You get it. You better bring your shovel.
I don't look for plastic on the beach. I'm looking for metal, man. I want some of that shiny gold metal. All right. We will take a quick break. Be right back with more. Which Catholic doctrine troubles you? With Dr. Carlo Broussard. As we read the Gospels, every Christian faces the question again and again, what does Jesus mean? Getting the answer right is critical to both growth in holiness and fruitful evangelization. Want to know Jesus better so you can introduce him to your friends? Then it's time to get serious about understanding his words. Why not join Catholic Answers for our 10th annual Apologetics Conference? Learn from me the parables, sermons, and conversations of Jesus Christ, September 26th through 29th, right here in sunny San Diego. Learn from our guests, Dr. Scott Hahn and Kimberly Hahn, Dr. Ray Guarendi, Father Sebastian Walsh, Billy Junker, Father Paul Check, and, of course, all of your favorite Catholic Answers apologists. It'll be 4 days of fun, faith, fellowship, and a live radio show. Seats are still available, but going fast. Visit CatholicAnswersConference.com or call 1-888-291-8000 today.
Why We're Catholic is the one book you can hand to anyone to invite them into or back to the Catholic faith. With more than 400,000 copies sold, Trent Horn's book has had a number one ranking on Amazon.com for 5 years running. Now available in softcover, bulk cases, ebook, and on Audible. Find out what the excitement is all about. Order your copies of Why We're Catholic at shop.catholic.com or visit whywearecatholic.com.
Many people have forgotten just how revolutionary the Bible creation stories are. But the first three chapters of Genesis are a powerful challenge to anyone in any generation who would undervalue human lives. In the Beginning, the new book by Monica Migliorino Miller will take you on a fantastic journey through the first chapters of Genesis, unfolding the richness of life as God sees it. Get In the Beginning today at shop.catholic.com or ask for it at a good Catholic bookstore. Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. You are welcome to call if there is some Catholic doctrine that troubles you. If you've been listening at all, you'll notice that whether you're Catholic or not, you're welcome. Whether your question is a challenge or, you know, like you would like to challenge something that the Catholic Church believes or teaches, it's a curious question. I don't understand that. Whatever is the nature of the question, if it has to do with you having trouble with the Catholic doctrine, you're welcome to call whatever your own background or current state regarding the faith is. 888-318-7884. Dr. Carlo Broussard is our guest. You can catch his new episodes of his podcast each Thursday. He goes into the Sunday Catholic readings the readings that will be read at Mass in the Catholic Church from the perspective of a faithful person, but particularly an apologist. How does an apologist look at those readings? Just go to sundaycatholicword.com. The cost exactly what you're paying right now for this radio program. It's nothing. You can just check it out each Thursday, SundayCatholicWord.com. Going to Lily now in Indiana, listening on the Catholic Answers Live app. Lily, thanks for downloading our app onto your phone. Go ahead with your question for Dr. Broussard.
Thank you. Dr. Broussard, I just have to say thank you so much for your program. The Sunday Catholic Word has really helped with doing a Bible study with a friend who's open to Catholicism now.
Awesome. Thank you so much for that. That's very kind of you. I appreciate you listening.
Yeah. So actually, this is a question stemming from our Bible study. What is kind of how would you explain the difference between like public and private revelation, and how public revelation is closed, but how we can still follow stuff like the rosary, but then like not contradict each other?
Yeah, great question. So with regard to private revelations, you can check out paragraph 67 in the Catechism of the Catholic Church, where it gives a nice little summary of what we believe about private revelations in contrast to what we call public revelation, right? So what is public revelation? Well, it's that body of truth that Jesus revealed to the apostles from the Father, and also including that truth that the Holy Spirit inspired the apostles to come to know while they were going around preaching and writing and stuff for the first century in the apostolic age. So that's what we mean by public revelation. And that revealed truth is found in both sacred scripture and sacred tradition. We call that, Lily, the quote-unquote deposit of faith, right? It's that body of truth that we must believe for the sake of our salvation. That is, for those to whom it is revealed. For those who come to know that truth and that revelation has been given to us, we were bound to assent to it, to believe it, to adopt it, to embrace it for the sake of salvation. Like, that's what Jesus has revealed to us. And to reject that revelation is to reject Jesus himself and thereby make ourselves subject to damnation, putting ourselves outside of Christ. So that's the nature of what we call public revelation. And according to church teaching, Lily, that public revelation is complete in and of itself. It's perfect, and there is nothing we can add to it to make it more perfect. Now, does it require unpacking and for us to kind of meditate on it and come to see the truths that are already there? Yeah, but our growth and our understanding of it doesn't perfect what's already there, because what's already there is perfect. All right, that's public revelation. Now, when the Catechism addresses private revelation, those revelations that Jesus has given to certain saints, which have been recognized by the authority of the church, the Catechism states, Lily, that they do not belong to the deposit of faith. Like, they're not part of that original group, body of truths that Jesus revealed to us and the Holy Spirit through the apostles. And it goes on to say that the private revelations are not meant to improve or complete Christ's definitive revelation. So that raises the question, well, what is their purpose? And the Catechism says the purpose of private revelations is to help us live more fully by it in a certain period of history. So Jesus gives us these little helps, these gifts, right? Communicated to us through certain mystics who are experiencing these things, messages to give us at a particular point in history to help us get through trying times. And always these messages are going to be, if legitimate and authentic, are going to be, as you put it, non-contradictory or consistent with what we already have and are bound to know in public revelation. And as the Catechism points out, we must always be subject to the guidance of the magisterium of the church, right? So those private revelations are subject to the judgment of the magisterium, the local bishop. Sometimes maybe the Pope might need to be involved, and to make a decision as to whether those private revelations are authentic or not and consistent with what we already know through public revelation. And so these private revelations are things that have been and continue to be given to individuals in certain periods of history, but it's that public revelation that we believe is complete and perfect with the death of the last apostle. And there will be no new public revelation that's going to be binding on us as Christians to believe for the sake of our salvation until Christ comes again in all of his glory. And he's going to blow our minds with some whole new revelation concerning God's providential plan, as the Catechism talks about in its section on eschatology in the end times.
Does that make sense, Lily?
Yeah, that definitely clears it up. Thank you.
All right.
Fantastic.
Have you got any of Dr. Broussard's books?
I haven't.
All right. Well, I'll send you one if you'd like. What's a good one for Carlo? Which one would you pick, Carlo?
Yeah, maybe. How about Meeting the Protestant Challenge? Since Lily is enjoying Sunday Catholic Word and dialoguing with her friend who's thinking about becoming Catholic, assuming that her friend is Protestant, Meeting the Protestant Challenge would be a good book. But if the friend is like skeptical and a skeptic of some sort, then maybe Prepare the Way. So maybe she can tell Edgar when Edgar talks to her which of those two her friend is.
All right.
And then Edgar can make that decision.
God bless you, Lily. Thank you for the call. Hang on and let Edgar know which of those two books you would like, and perhaps we'll hear from you again. The number here, 888-318-7884. We're asking you, which Catholic doctrine troubles you? If there's one that troubles you, whether you're Catholic or not, 888-318-7884. Up next, Jeremiah is in Florida, also listening on the Catholic Answers Live app. Jeremiah, thank you for downloading the app onto your phone. Go ahead with your question for Dr. Broussard.
Yeah, no doubt. Thanks for taking my call, y'all. So I'm a recent convert to Catholicism from Calvary Chapel. 10 years ago, about, I was baptized in a beach baptism in the ocean by a couple lay people from Calvary. It's Trinitarian, but I don't really remember the details. Anyway, I'm in RCIA. They say get proof of baptism. I go to Calvary Chapel office. They don't know what I'm talking about. I give them the information for them to type me up some little thing saying, yeah, I was baptized in the Trinitarian formula. Turn it in. They're like, cool. Now, I was under the impression I'm going to get a conditional baptism the whole time. I have a lot to question about my baptism. There's two people out there, all this type of stuff. And then I found out that even the Catholic Church has recalled some of their own baptism because they said we baptize instead of I baptize or whatever. And I don't really remember what happened at all 10 years ago.
Okay.
And then they're like, no, you can't do recondition because the bishop signed off on it and that's okay. And I'm like, well, how would they even know if I don't know? Now the question is this. I'm like, maybe I'm screwed, but now my daughter's going through the same process. She was baptized like me, and now she's in her second year because she's 9 years old, and her catechist is saying no, she can't have a conditional baptism either. And they're saying, well, her her confirmation and her profession of faith take care of that. I'm like, maybe for perceived discrepancies, but if it's actually an invalid baptism, it don't take care of it. That just makes the confirmation and stuff invalid too. And there's no way of knowing. And like, they could have fixed this easily and just given me a conditional baptism. And it's making me trip to the point I want to go to Greek Orthodox just to get the baptism and bounce back. I don't know if that's crazy or I should fight this.
Yeah.
I want to submit to the bishop. But like, I don't see how they could know when the Catholic Church has recalled some of their own baptisms for one word.
Sure.
How do they know what these Protestants said to me out in the ocean? I don't know. And they said it's not salvific before they did it.
Okay, let's get an answer from Carlo on that.
All right, Jeremy. So first of all, brother, I feel you. And I sympathize with your question marks that are rising in your head and your frustration. Let me first of all say, do not go to the Orthodox and then bounce back. I would recommend against that. All right? I would invite you to be consistent and to stay with what the Spirit has led you to come into the fold of the Catholic Church. Now, what to do to go forward on this? So just put yourself in the shoes of maybe the bishop or those to whom you're talking. You presented to them a piece of paper based upon, as I understood your articulation, from this Calvary Chapel community that's saying, we baptized you with Trinitarian formula. All right? Now, they are trusting that testimony from that Calvary Chapel community. But you, given the one who was there and experienced it and not really remembering what's going on, and you kind of know these people and they're like, well, we really don't know, but here's a piece of paper for you. Jeremiah, that seems to me to be sufficient enough reason for you to have reasonable doubt for the validity of your baptism, because you know those folks. You know what they told you and how uncertain they were concerning their baptism of you, and whether or not that piece of paper that they gave you to present to your bishop means anything, right? So I would recommend that, given your knowledge and your doubt concerning this, that you maybe try and go to another parish in the diocese, perhaps, where you might have a priest who would be willing to do a conditional baptism for you. It seems hard to imagine that a bishop would prevent a priest who has sufficient enough evidence to doubt the validity of your prior baptism, and thereby giving him permission, not giving him permission to do a conditional baptism. I find it hard to believe that a bishop would prevent a priest from doing that. I can totally imagine a priest who is making the judgment on himself to, like, not want to conditionally baptize you for whatever reason. So my recommendation, Jeremiah, would be to go and try and talk to other priests in the diocese that you've heard about, or if you talk to other people about, who are holy and who love the church and who love the sacraments, and maybe go and talk to that priest and explain your situation and say, hey, look, I have good reason to think that my prior baptism probably might not be valid. Could you conditionally baptize me? And I'm confident, Jeremiah, that there's got to be some priest in your diocese who would be willing to give you a conditional baptism in order to ensure that you're going to be okay.
All right, so I'm going to come back to you, Jeremiah. Does that, what Carlos said, just make sense to you?
It does, but would I have to recondition? I'm confirmed already. Do I have to reconfirm as well? And that can yes or no.
I mean, if there is sufficient enough evidence that you are doubting the validity of your baptism and you're not baptized, then it may very well be the case that you would have to do another round of confirmation, right? To be confirmed again.
But I have to go through RCIA again?
Well, that I don't know. I mean, you're going to have to talk to
the bishop.
You're going to have to talk to the particular pastor at that parish, whether he's going to make you go through his RCIA class or just say, hey, look, I know you went through another class. You have this situation, so I'll conditionally baptize you, administer the sacrament of confirmation. He's going to have to get permission from the bishop. But if he's holy and smart and with the church, he can make a case to the bishop for your situation and thereby persuading the bishop to give permission for him to administer the conditional baptism to you and to administer the sacrament of confirmation conditionally.
I don't know. Jeremiah, does that help you?
I'll make it quick. Yes, it does, and I'll make this quick. Now, I've already went to two parishes, just to let you know, and if I'm going to keep doing what you said. If I don't find a parish, let's say, for instance, I don't find one. When I said go to the Orthodox, I was saying just because I know they have vowed sacraments. I was saying just to get baptism and confirmation and then bounce back. In the case I can't find a priest to do it, why would I not be allowed to do that? Or why would you advise against that?
By participating in those sacraments, you have a visible manifestation of some sort of unity. It's speaking a visible language of unity with the Orthodox community to receive their sacraments there. I would want to avoid that as much as possible. There are extreme circumstances to where you would be permitted to do that, but I don't see death as one of the circumstances right now, so I would avoid that in this circumstance. Let's just say hypothetically there ain't no parish in your diocese, I would recommend, if you're serious about it and you have sufficient evidence for the invalidity of your baptism, maybe try to go to another diocese and get some help there. That's the only thing I could say and recommend. You might get some who would say, listen, just relax, it's okay, go forward with it. The bishop gave you that permission. I mean, the bishop's recognizing it. Move forward and trust in God's providence, because check it out, Jeremiah, even if your baptism is invalid and your confirmation is invalid, God knows that. And by submitting to the bishop and following the bishop's direction, you do not have to worry about the state of your salvation, because you know you are honestly seeking the Lord and that you are submitting to the bishop's judgment that these sacraments were valid. And that would be perfectly fine, bro. And you could move forward in peace and have contentment and not have that anxiety. So you have two paths there that you can take, Jeremiah. And I'll leave it to your discernment and prayer and seeking counsel from holy priests as to which path you're going to take there.
Can I ask you two quick questions, Carlo? Because I'm just curious about that. I mean, could he employ a canon lawyer to take this the case up if he wanted to?
Yeah, I would definitely recommend that. You know, try to find a good canon lawyer in the diocese to give you some coaching on this and some direction.
And when you said, the other question I had was, when you said go to another diocese, it doesn't have to be a neighboring diocese. Like, you could go to a Byzantine parish and ask them.
That's right. Yeah, I didn't think about that. Yeah, you might go to a Byzantine parish, but So.
Or a Maronite that, or.
That's right. And they may be open to conditionally baptizing him. Yeah.
I'm not, Jeremiah, I'm not trying to add problems, just trying to get clarifications on a couple of things. There's always the avenue of, as Carlos said, trust in the providence of the Lord. No one who has ever trusted in that providence has been disappointed that they did. We will have to take a quick break, though. We'll be right back with more questions for Carlo on Catholic doctrines that might trouble you. If you've got one, give us a call, 888-318-7884.
There's only one Catholic Answers Live.
Underwriting for Catholic Answers Live is provided by Real Estate for Life. Real Estate for Life connects home buyers and sellers to real estate agents while supporting pro-life organizations. On the web at realestateforlife.org.
One of the biggest mistakes a Christian can make is to try to do good without God's help. Saint Therese said, when we trust only ourselves and not God, our soul becomes incapable of virtue. Her remedy? Works of charity. And the greatest work of charity is to share the gospel. At St. Paul Street Evangelization, a Catholic nonprofit, we encourage you to share the gospel with someone who doesn't know Jesus. Catholic Answers is supported in part by St. Paul Street Evangelization. StreetEvangelization.com.
Pope Francis tells us, becoming a priest or a man or woman religious is not primarily our own decision. Rather, it's the response to a call of love. Do you feel as if God may be calling you to religious life? If so, contact a religious order faithful to the magisterium or your diocesan vocation. For information on the priesthood or religious life, visit EWTN.com/religious life today.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. Lots of great conversations today. Maybe you'd like to get in on the conversation. You're welcome here, whether you're Catholic or not, whether you're a Christian or not, whether you're a believer of any kind or not, you're welcome to call 888-318-7884. If there's something you know that the Catholic Church teaches and you don't like it, or you're bothered by it, or you don't understand it, if it troubles you, 888-318-7884 is the number. Sarah in Pensacola, Florida, has been waiting a long time, and I apologize for that. Sarah, listening on the Guadalupe Radio Network, go ahead with your, do you have a Catholic doctrine that troubles you, Sarah?
Yes, I do. I really have a problem calling these priests father. Jesus made it quite clear that we only have one Father, and that's the Father in heaven, his Father. So why are we calling these priests Father?
All right, it's a great question. And so in our conversation, Sarah, I'm going to ask you a couple of questions, and I'm not trying to be like, I got you, or to try to be a jerk about it. I just want to ask you some questions to sort of guide along the thought process here, okay? So notice the question that you're stating is, I have trouble calling a priest father because Jesus says in Matthew 23, verse 9, call no man father. All right. Let me ask you this. Are you open to calling biological fathers father, like St. Paul does in Ephesians 6, 2, when he says, in quotes the fourth commandment, honor your father and your mother? Are you open to that?
Of course.
Okay. All right, so we have at least one example to where we could call some man father and it not contradict or go against what Jesus is saying there,
look,
okay?
Man, I know what you're doing. You're not going to convince me. You know, this is a patriarchy. This is about control. These priests, half of them are arrogant and prideful.
Okay, Sarah. So now you've shifted targets here. You've shifted targets. So you initially asked a question about how we can reconcile calling priests father and what Jesus says in Matthew 23:9. Now, I am more than happy to address that problem and that conflict. But notice, Sarah, now all of a sudden you've shifted to all of these things that have nothing to do with that initial question concerning power and control and hierarchy and this and that. And those are problems, Sarah, that I would encourage you to continue working through, right? But I don't think those are going to be the problems that we can deal with on the air right now, because those sorts of problems, given the tone of your voice, causes a sort of emotional distress. And I think that's not going to be beneficial for us here on the air. But if the problem is the reconciliation between Matthew 23:9, and where Jesus says, call no man father, and us calling priests father, well, then I would advise you, Sarah, to go to Catholic.com and just type in that passage, Matthew 23:9, or just type in, call no man on earth father. And Sarah, you're going to get a plethora of resources, articles, videos, podcasts, etc., that will solve that problem for you, or at least help you to think through that problem. Now, all those other issues you started bringing up in a rapid-fire manner, those are things that, unfortunately, you're going to have to work on a personal level. And I'm sorry you're feeling those feelings, and those feelings might be legit. There might be legit causes giving rise to those feelings. But I would encourage you to pray and ask the Holy Spirit to help you work through those issues.
Sarah, I'm just going to say thank you then, because that sounds like that's about as far as that conversation is going to go. But you're always welcome here. We'd love it if you'd call again anytime, 888-318-7884. Carlo, this one came from Tallahassee, Florida. Paul wasn't able to stay on the line, but says, I'm a catechist. Why does the church not follow Leviticus? I think he means chapter 19 when it comes to tattoos.
Yeah, Leviticus chapter 19, verse 28, do not put tattoo marks on yourselves. I am the Lord. The answer to the question is simply because the ceremonial precepts that constituted or made up the Levitical law are no longer binding on us as Christians. The prohibition of tattoos is one of those ceremonial precepts, or not ceremonial, I should have said disciplinary precepts, because this is not really a ceremony, it's a disciplinary precept. Tattooing our bodies is one of those disciplinary precepts. And so therefore, we as Christians are no longer bound by the prohibition of tattoos. And here's a way to justify that line of reasoning, right? So imagine this, Si, consider this. 19:28 of Leviticus says, do not put tattoos on yourselves. Some Christians might think, well, the Bible says no tattoos there in verse 28. Well, if that were true and we were still bound by this prohibition and disciplinary precept, well, then we would also be bound by Leviticus 19:19, where it says, nor shall there come upon you a garment of cloth made of two kinds of stuff. Well, the shirt I'm wearing is made up of different kinds of things. It's not 100% cotton.
Polyester blend. Let's call it a polyester blend.
There you go. It's a different stuff making up the clothing that I'm wearing.
Yeah.
But of course, nobody's going to accept that we're still bound by that disciplinary precept in verse 19 of Leviticus 19. And so therefore, we can reasonably see that we're no longer bound by the disciplinary precept of the prohibition of marking our bodies with tattoos. And a similar example of this side, which can be helpful, is to look at what St. Paul says in Colossians 2:16, where he says, let no one pass judgment on you in questions of food and drink or with regard to a festival or a new moon or Sabbaths. Notice St. Paul is giving us some examples of ceremonial precepts that we're no longer bound to hold to as Christians. And it would follow from that that other precepts belonging to the old law we would be free from as well. As the author of Hebrews says, whenever there is a change in the priesthood, there is a change in the law. And so those aspects of the law that do not flow from our human nature, therefore do not belong to the natural moral law, are no longer binding on us. But those precepts, moral precepts that do flow from our nature and thus constitute the natural moral law, such as the Ten Commandments, they are still binding.
Dr. Carla Broussard is our guest. So that's, I think that is very helpful, that last thing you said, because so many people will be like, well, you let go of this one, why not that one? And
right.
It's because there are different kinds of laws in the Old
Testament.
Right.
And somebody might challenge and say, well, tattoos are conflicting with the natural moral law, and that's something we would have to talk about.
Yeah. Okay. Thanks very much, Paul. I hope that that answer was helpful to you. Thanks to everybody who called in the first hour. We're going to do this again, and we're going to start it up for a second hour in like a couple minutes. So hang on. If you're on the line, stay on the line. If you haven't called yet, there might be just one or two lines open during the break. If you've got a Catholic doctrine that troubles you, 888-318-7884.